So normally where I go, some people know who I am. But you can't ask on the top of the Lebowski, the Bowser, the Hogan. Okay, so I know the minute is when you have to come ask after Thursday how great you are. And then you have to talk about Chesed. Then you have to say that the truck is way up there. Do this. But don't forget the vibrations of the mother. There's a fantastic verse from the professor that says, it's a Danish author, it's Gomer. Gomer says, you should do as other markings and from other comes we increase in joy, and the opposite is, of course, when love comes we decrease in joy. How about that? If this is an only then I'll try and share. Tinny. Can I say it? No good? It's going to be very hard for me to share. We'll try it. What's that? No good?
It's good.
Two say it's good. It's getting better. Okay, thank you. Alright. So one more time. Again, it's annoying, I'll project it somehow. When other comes we increase in joy, when love comes we decrease in joy. So imagine like this. Here's other will make a smiley, and here's other will make a frowny. What would you imagine is the baseline, the point of departure? That would be R. So if it comes to an end, it's the entire idea. When other comes, we increase in joy. When other comes, we decrease in joy. So the baseline is simpler. That's a Jewish perspective. But you have to imagine it. The more or the less, but we're never bereft of simpler. We're never sans simpler. So, but nonetheless, now our job is to diminish. And that doesn't mean just if you're a carnivore and you can't deal without meat. So I want to speak about a subject, I thought about it so good, that is remind the simple. And, but because you have a hard day today, and what's with the shirt? Is it missing day or something? No, about that. I'm going to talk about the Holocaust, I'm going to light. When I grew up, I'm 27, but when I grew up, we saw numbers everywhere, numbers engraved in the flesh. And I wonder how many numbers you've seen. And how many children have seen. My grandchild has seen it at all. And in this regard, I want to relate three stories. Erev Yom Kippur is the most crowded day in the Medinet Torah. S-R-O. Squeeze your moment. In my name, Yerushalayim, which is a pretty devout neighborhood, Erev Yom Kippur is the most crowded day in the mikvah, and it's so crowded and boisterous and noisy. And yeah. Everyone's on top of each other. And I can't describe this too delicately because the mikvah is no way to conceal because everything is revealed. And it's and every speaking in the edition, it's a count of kajar, very boisterous. There's one kid from across the street who wears a bag of sheep for beginners. How many of us wear some mayach? They said on his t-shirt, what's the address? I'm just joking. He had a hearing in a ponytail, clearly he was not a customer or shaman. He felt legitimately very much out of place in it. He placed his palms over his biceps, very apparent to me and to others, and had a tendency that was not appropriate for Erev Yom Kippur. I dare say not appropriate for Gotcha Freyl, but certainly not the Yom Kippur. And everyone, this people was not especially subtle. Out of Subtle's heavy metal and subtle. And they're gorking again. This gorking is highly embarrassed, about to step into the pool, and then slips and trips and grabs the rail, and there's this roaring silence in the mikvah. Sphinx like silence. Picture a forest after trees fell. Imagine the mudflood staying after my case is struck out. And no one's wondering. And these little boy tattoos are flying through the air. These were not mandibles. I'm not going to describe it. It's the most inappropriate. Don't use your imagination. It's terrible. And before it was so boisterous, and now you can hear heartbeats. Everyone froze. The kid turned alabaster, so I'm crashing, he's going to jump in, and he would never come out of the pool. And then Elvin Yemen, this happened 21 years ago, and Elvin Yemen walked across the moist marble floor. And I can still hear my ears of whack, 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 as he walked across the moist marble floor. When most of the singers were dead and alive, they said to this heavily Yiddishy, European accent in English, "Don't tell the other time. I also have a tattoo. Went to numbers and bears and flesh. Numbers are not my heaven, not your heaven. Let's begin to live together." It's going on this way. I have a friend, actually, I have a friend who has a friend. I mean, I know that, but it doesn't matter. My friend's friend is in fact Ike Hirschroth. He's a psychiatrist in Manhattan. He wrote a book about depression titled "The Little Darkness, My Little Friend." And he grew up in Washington Heights in the 50s. Now, if you grew up in the Heights in the 50s, you saw a lot of numbers. And especially the summer day vacation in Lockaways, it was all over. So much so that when he was 9 years old, he asked his mother, "When will I get my numbers?" Which caused the Bible Kitchen drama. Ike Hirschroth's uncle was a physician here in the Castle Mountains, and his aunt, the doctor's wife, was his assistant. And she called to Ike, "This Sunday, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein is coming to the office. Would you like to meet him?" Now, one kid growing up in Washington Heights wouldn't give his right arm to Ike Hirschroth. He said, "Of course." He scrubbed his face, put on his yacht finery. He's sitting in the waiting room looking as close as he could, waiting for Moshe to come in. And he goes, "The waiting room is more and more and more full, fuller. Finally, it's so full." And Moshe walks in. His hand goes over, says, "Rabbi Feinstein, I'm very sorry, but the place is very full. We're going to have to wait a turn." And she plants a kiss on both cheeks. And Ike Hirschroth melted into the floor voice. He could finally climb back up. He crawled over and he spoke to me and he said, "I'm shoulder to the pleasure. I can't say this in the floor. I'm so sorry. But my aunt, she's not religious. She doesn't know it." She's got the numbers. She's holier than I. And lastly, the after Sandra Rav, Sandra Rebbe, "Who should we go to this day and age for a brother?" He said, "Go to Shul. You see the men putting on the tefillin, you see the numbers engraved in the flesh. Those are the ones you can ask for a bracha from. They have their affidavit of Shemayim right there on the screen." So, what I want to tell you, and they didn't tell me how long.
3 hours, 1 minute.
So, this is good. I just want you to know, first of all, regarding the Holocaust, you should be aware of the fact. It's an arithmetic fact, a mathematical fact. We lost 1/3 of our people. 6 million contemporary research is closer to 7 million. But from a Torah perspective, it wasn't 1/3. At the time of the Holocaust, there were 3 of the 6 high schools in America that were poorly attended. There wasn't one middle school, but they didn't have those. The number of boys learning at yeshiva level in Israel was under 500, which means the heart and soul of Torah Judaism was in Lithuania, White Russia, Poland, Hungary, Romania. That was not decimated, that was annihilated. Over 95%. Just unbelievable to put out as rejuvenation. It's a miracle in the universe. Okay. So, we have to start somewhere. I'm going to start with 1938, because we're not going to go all day. 1938, there were 3 seminal events, beginning with the Auschwitz. In March of 1938, Hitler believed 2 countries would speak the same language and have the same flag. So there was a referendum in Austria, and the Austrians voted 99.7% if they wanted to be under Nazi dominion. What happened to 250,000 Jews? Not to vote that very, very dramatic elections. Now the Austrians said it was done against Europe. I was born in Austria, I was raised in Austria. There's footage in the Abishan of the Austrians greeting for their survival. They were not upset, they were jumping for joy. And once the Germans took over Austria. See, from January of 1933, whatever you wanted to do to a Jew in Germany, you could. Pillage, plunder, rape, murder. And there was no recourse to go to the police. But you were Austrian. It's like, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, took March 38 to protect the citizens. It was like a pressure cooker with lips of wolf. And the elderly man and women were forced to clean the streets, the police with their arms folded, so finally, choosing to do something productive and not just counting their money. Some of them are thrown into an icy river if they're trying to get out. Bricks are thrown at their head. And these pictures of destruction of Western Germany are being sent back to America, into the free world. And there's agitation in America doing something. So the President of the United States, named after the highway in Manhattan, had to bow to the pressure. And he was a fantastic politician, but he didn't want to do anything. So he decided he was going to make a big spritz to accomplish nothing. So what was convenient was at the ABM conference, 33 countries are invited to see what to do for the refugees. The Jews of Germany and Austria would need more than anything to get out. They looked at this conference as an opportunity for their safety. 33 countries. Every country was given a chance to speak. And the reason that America was interested in even doing this was America didn't want to look like a humanitarian issue, they're not sensitive. In America, they were concerned, particularly the cabinet, in terms of the plight, the suffering of one Austrian Jew. His name was? I'm not hearing? That's a German Jew who was already in America at the time. That's not a Jew. His name was Dr. Sigmund Freud. And the way the mind works, it's easy to think about one over a quarter of a million. It's easy to think about Anne Frank over 6 million. It's easy to think about 6 million paperclips or pocketclips over 6 million souls. On a tour guide in that show, and the way the museum is created by the curators is that it has to be guided, it should be guided. And it's amazing, we're using all the time, probably more than should be. And I hear these tour guides and spooling data about an infinite crime. Who can absorb all statistics? So what I'm always doing is telling personal stories that we can connect. What's the most famous story of the Holocaust? It's an easy question. The most famous story is Anne Frank. Now, Anne's story is not a reflective story. Anne was not in the ghettos, was not in the camps. She had a roof over her head, a modicum of food with her family. But because it's a story, it's easier to write. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to tell the story. And here's a really good segue to a remarkable story, the probably most remarkable story I know. We wrote a book. When the war was over, understanding those who had suffered wanted to tell their story and how they had been tortured. And the people who couldn't tell the story then, and basically had not yet told their story, are the children. I call this the final frontier. And I wanted to capture their story. And I went around the world. I spent 14 years on this. And this company wrote a book called their own children about not children's stories that reflect the story of the Holocaust. And just really see a significant addition. And after 14 years of work, we're about to go to press, and we neglected one little thing, which is pretty significant, is we forgot we didn't yet have a book cover. Now, the cover to a book is a very important component. Whoever tells me they don't judge a book by its cover, I know they never tried to sell a book. So we had to get a cover in no time, so we put the team on it, and as the kids, and we're going through all the archives, and we came across this picture. I don't know if you can really see it from the distance. It's a very dramatic picture. It's a picture that was shot the day that Auschwitz was liberated. It's really dozens and dozens of kids, and we zoomed in on a cover. And the copyright holder is the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. So I requested permission to use the picture. And when you request the picture to use for a book, you have to fill out an affidavit. And commit you're not going to make any changes. You're not going to zoom, take an angle. So I said, I'm going to make this change, this change, this change, that change, this change, that change, this change. Made the request. The next day he said, no problem, you can have the picture in 3 weeks. 3 weeks. I don't know if I had 10 days. Anyway. And everyone knows that to turn a picture from low resolution to high resolution takes about 10 seconds, not 3 weeks. But it's a large bureaucracy, several hundred employees, and they're part of being Israeli. So I thought what's indicated here is protection. And I had a friend in Baltimore, a very powerful Jew. They say that in his cell phone, he has the private number of every senator and congressman. I figured, hey, Baltimore, Washington, this is Shulam. And his son was learning yeshiva next to my house. So I ran to yeshiva, I said, Aryeh, and I thought this was a rhetorical question, Aryeh, is your father connected to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum? He said, no. And I walked out of the room, disenchanted, crestfallen, melancholy. And just stopped up there and tells me, but my mother is on the board. He's going to ring his neck. So she's a judge. I wrote her an email, said, Chaya Fingusen. Chaya, that's when you could help. This is the tag number, this is the one number picture. I need you to get it from me yesterday. The next morning, I have the picture. And then it occurred to me, again, no one can see from the distance. The picture is sepia. And in sync with my respect to triangles, I like an individual, I wanted to color one thing, to show the image. What the color one. And I didn't have permission for this, and I thought this required permission. So once again, I write Judge Friedman, and I said to her, please, get me permission. I want to color one child. Show me back, I'm very busy, I'm convening a murder trial, and I'm on time. I said, Chaya, this is killing me. I need to do this for you. So she writes me back, yay. I made the request. I cannot assure you that they're going to get permission. I thought to myself, come on. It's the Holocaust. It's apple pie. It's money. Did I have a problem? And I'm going to use the technical term with you. I had what's called a press cue. A press cue that night, at 10 o'clock at night, in the largest press in Israel, arguably the largest press in the Middle East. Now, a press cue means if you don't print and you have to queue, then you have to pay for it anyways, and then if you get your act together, you can't do it the next day, get online all over again. And wait another 2 weeks. So, figuring was no problem. 3 hours before the press queue, it's been about 2 hours and 48 minutes before press queue, I get an email, Dear Rabbi Teller, from the head archivist of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, we regret to inform you may not use the picture. If you wish to use the picture in its pristine state without any alteration, you may. But once you make the slightest change, you may not. And particularly, if you want to highlight this boy, he recently spoke out, he's very sensitive, and our legal department said unequivocally, you may not use the picture. Shrek and a half. Our records lights, they're on the drums, and 2 hours and 20 minutes, we have 10,000 photos. So I'm not such a pushover. And a little bit of fire. So I said, please send me his phone number and his address, and his phone number and his name, and I'll call him up. So she writes me back 1 hour and 47 minutes before press queue. We don't know his name, nor do we know where he lives. I said, but, you just told me he sent his book out. 51 minutes before press queue, she sent me an online clipping of this picture. That was shot in the Auschwitz was liberated. And 70th anniversary, 4 of the people in this picture, now of course in the groups of old age, went back to Auschwitz and pointed to themselves as youth in the picture. It was apparent, with using the Shishita, it was Mashba from this article, that this boy that I covered, his name is Hirsch. I don't know if that was his first or his last name. It's a common first name and last name. It was apparent that I think his name was Hirsch, and it said it came from Europe. So I now have 41 minutes to find maybe Hirsch in Europe. So Sherlock Teller is thinking, where would the Auschwitz survivor? Now, if you look at the picture, the kid looks pretty good. So I knew it couldn't be a goal. Because to look this good, it has to be in Europe. Hungary was conquered in March 1944. To be in this shape, it has to be in Europe. Where would Hungarian and Auschwitz survivor live in Europe today? So I discounted England, Russia, Israel, Eurasia, and for good measure I threw in Liechtenstein, Monaco, and I'm now down to 42 countries with 28 minutes to go. And then I limited it down and figured if he'd be anywhere in Europe, he'd probably be either Belgium or Switzerland. 16 minutes to press queue, I happen to have a really good friend who lives in Switzerland, Zurich, which a loser. Very intelligent person, and he works for IBM, or Shiv. So I called and said, Mr. Loser, I need you to find me maybe Hirsch in Switzerland. He said, would maybe be his first name or his last name? I said, I don't know. He said, Hanukkah. What have you been drinking? I gotta find this guy. I got 10 minutes, there's no time. He said, listen, is he from? I don't know. You know, if you give me a name, I got an idea, I'll find him. I said, you know what? I'm sure he's in the area. Try Gavor or Tibor Hirsch. Gavor or Tibor is the Hungarian equivalent of Mike or Steve. I hear him typing. Gavor Hirsch, 89-year-old engineer. Here's his phone number. 7 minutes of press play, I call him up. So my husband, Dutch, gives me permission. I fire off an email to Nazis Holocaust Memorial, and I said, I have permission. And you have any problem, you give him a call. Here's his number, but it's already 9 o'clock, and he's not in touch, but I don't want you to call tonight. I want you to know, it was easy for me to get his guy's permission, but it is for him to parallel the mark. I took that as a moment. That first word. There's a book, a boat called the SS St. Louis, which I'm sure you've heard of, the ship of the damned. There are many cruise ships, it's the most infamous of all. It's traveling to America in May, and the people on the boat, these obviously very wealthy German Jews, had paid a fortune, to be able to get paperwork to dock in Cuba. When the boat is tethered in Havana, it's docked to the port, the Cubans want to dock. Now, in Latin America, Central America, South America, a bride is a way of life. I'll bet you, the one of the first who learned Spanish is El Bravo. So if they want a bride, what should you do? Let's try that again. 1,000 Jews there, 937 Jews, 736 of them have legitimate American visas that will only be valid in 3 months' time. They need a ride. What should you do? Long day, I guess. They need a ride. That's what you do. But the leader of American Jewry, his name was Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, whom we used to call my brother Basir. Rabbi Stephen S. Wise was a quintessential reform rabbi. Good crop of hair, well built, stage presence, rhetorical abilities, cushy FDR, Eleanor, members of the cabinet, a rabbi. The bribes against the law. We can't violate the law. And he was not prepared to do anything. The captain, Bishop Gustav Schroeder, a German, was a benevolent, magnanimous humanitarian. He figured, well, America's a humane country. In 737 legitimate American visas, and he steams the ship up and down the Eastern Sea coast. How does America greet the boat? With a Coast Guard cutter to intercept. Had they jumped off and swam 20 miles to Miami, had it been doable, they would have been sent back. In the end, this boat goes back to where it came from. Because not a country on earth would get hit. And overall, the majority perish. I want to contrast this with one other story you're probably not familiar with, called the Moussi Negotiations. Jean-Marie Moussi was the former Swiss president, a chum of Himmler, a Nazi sympathizer, and during the war, his perspective changed. Towards the end of the war, the Vahat Saba, not to be confused with the ambulance war, the Gedolim of America, so the organization that was founded by the Heinoiser, Brzezinski, the Rebbe Lavar, Heinoiser, sent a telegram to his Talmud with Blazer Silver to try and save Talmud in Europe. So the Gedolim of America, Ivan Kutler, Blazer Silver, Ron Kalmanovich, Yashagar Soloveitchik, and important Balabatin, Irving Bunim, Maitress, Louis Septimus, Stephen S. Klein, work around the clock under a man and his staff to try and save Jews. Alive still in Europe are 800,000 Jews in the camps. So Levi, at the direction of Ron Kutler, working with the Strindlov family in Switzerland, dealing with Jean-Marie Moussi, trying to negotiate to save 800,000 lives. Himmler is much more practical than Hitler, wants to save his neck, and he's the chief cop in Germany. All the guards in the camps are his acolytes. He's afraid that when they liberate the camps, they'll consider him war criminals, they'll have him shot on the spot. He wants to have the status of POWs. We're almost done. So he demands medicine and trucks, and the Bar Itzel cannot come up with this. So he changes his demand to 5 million Swiss francs. which is about equivalent to $1 million. Now, I'm aware of the fact that $1 million today is not worth a cent. But still, $1 million is $800,000. That is the cheapest Azuki Bush. It's one of the greatest special record in history. $1 million. But the fund itself doesn't have $1 million. But the joint distribution really does. So Martin Cutler goes before the joint. Now Martin Cutler was the classic Lithuanian Yoshishima. Short, red, long black coat, stooped, sparkling in the hand. By looking at him, you cannot tell how clever he is. He does not converse in English. He speaks Yiddish. And Irving Dean, the head of Israel, is his translator. He goes before the joint and said, we need $1 million to save these 800,000 Jews. And the joint says, we can't do it. We can't do it because it violates the British blockade, which is sacrosanct. As Acapulco Harbor means trade with the enemy, which is a felonious crime. And for all I know, it's a treasonous crime. But to the government of America, it is despicable to violate American law and odious to give money to the Germans. And yet, there's a higher law. And the higher law is to koch nefesh to save a life. And the higher law is to get treated to rescue a captive. And the higher law is our responsibility, one truth towards his brother. And he cannot get through. And he begs and pleads, cajoles and wheels, and finally, in desperation, he begins to cry. He said, okay, we'll give you the money, provide you with a license, the American government can get $1 million to Nazi enemy. The only person born in America who could authorize this license was, of course, the president, named after the Harvard Lincoln. So Martin Cutler, the very chief, travels to Washington, he goes to the White House, and apparently the president felt that the plight of 800,000 Jews was not important enough for his time. He sent him his hyper-assimilated Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Morgan Thatcher Jr. And you can imagine, Morgan Thatcher Jr. is an extremely assimilated Jew. And there's no one who was going to authorize $1 million of taxpayer money to go to Nazi enemy. And he refuses. They have a heart of cover, begs and pleads, and he will not give in. In desperation, reminds us to be able to tell them, you are worthless, and Washington is meaningless if you can't save the life of one child in Europe. There's no way in the world that Barnes went, that June was going to tell the Secretary of the Treasury in the White House, you are worthless, and Washington is meaningless. He gives him a little switch, and the rabbi is very disappointed, hoping the future will be a greater help. Now, Barnes does not understand English. As I like to joke, he was an observant Jew. He sees from Henry Morgan Jr.'s expression of what he had said, and not the immaculate transitive since I've been close for myself, tell him precisely what I told you. At that point, I remember not about to violate the dictates of the government of the world, whose government should receive his laces your time, and socks you pulled up in other matters of sartorial concern. He says in a very local tone, Mr. Secretary, the rabbi has asked me to inform you that you are worthless, and Washington is meaningless. Can't save the life of one child in Europe. At that point, Henry Morgan Jr. collapsed on a table like this for the purest of the eternity. When he finally raises his head, his eyes are dealt with a bed of tears, cascading down. She says, tell the rabbi, I've forgotten who I am. Put my neck on the chopping block, save the brethren. And Henry Morgan Jr. is a great hero. Willing to risk his career on behalf of his brethren. Also, he was discovered by an American Jew. Swiss Jew and Hitler himself intervened to make sure it wouldn't happen. But Henry Morgan Jr. will be remembered forever and what he's willing to risk his career and have his brethren. That's an important tale. In life, we have to make decisions. Difficult ones or convenient ones. You make the difficult decision, that's how you remember. You make the convenient one, that's what you've forgotten. I'll give you one more example, much better known. Oscar Schindler was a dishonest businessman, a womanizer, extremely checkered past. He wrote a book on dysfunctional marriage. And yet he saved the 1,200 Jews during the Holocaust. Had it not been for the latter, if he'd be remembered, and that's a major if, he'd be remembered as a creep. And that name Schindler is synonymous with heroism, bravery, courage. courage, self-sacrifice, synonymous. Like vaseline, petroleum jelly, and Kleenex means tissues, Q-tips means kind of swabs, Shimon means self-sacrifice. He changed his name. And we can too. It's all making those difficult decisions. Okay, I conclude by telling you, it's repeated that several times, but at the end of Kinos, there are two elegies that were added, one from Schwab, one from the Bokhara Rebbe. The Bokhara Rebbe writes, it's not a statute to remember on Tisha B'Av. Every day, we held to those martyrs and to remember their travail. I can tell you, in conjunction with Bob Barretti, it's a timeless story. There's a black painter that was painting Bob Barretti's house, and they were taking all the pictures off the wall, and part of it scratched. My friend Russell Chapman was having his house painted by a black painter. They're taking all the paintings off the wall, and then they're going to leave them on the wall. And one of the large ones was a blow up with the Bokhara Rebbe. And the black painter said, "Is that your rabbi?" He said, "No." He said, "Why isn't he your rabbi?" "He's not my rabbi, let's get on with the job." "But why isn't he your rabbi?" "He's not my rabbi, let's get on." "But why is he not my rabbi? Look at all this rabbi. Here is painted, very religious, very rabbi. But why isn't he your rabbi? He's not my rabbi." And then the black painter said, "He's my rabbi." He said, "What the?" He pulled out a smaller, pulled out a photograph of Bob Rebbe. He said, "Look, I'll tell you." He said, "One morning, I was painting the house, the Rebbe came home and said to me, 'Did you have breakfast?' I said, 'No.' He said, 'Sit down.' He waited upon me, and he said to me, 'I want to tell you something.' I knew just what he was going to say. I heard the shmooze a million times. He's going to tell me, 'I paid you good money, I want a perfect job.' And the Rebbe said, 'We once had a little perfection, and everything was the way it was supposed to be. But because of our sins, the temple was destroyed. And ever since, we've never had that perfection. So I cannot ask you to do a perfect job. But I'd like you to try your hardest.' And you know how these people recommend? He gave me hundreds of specific. No one ever offered me breakfast. They'll say to me, 'I paid good money. I want a perfect job.' And I say to them, 'You want a perfect job? There's no temple. I don't want a perfect job.'" So to really end, in Yad Vashem, I'm sure most of you have been there in the Children's Memorial, and the genius of the architect, the person who painted the mummy's building, Shpilo from Los Angeles, who recognized the great irony of this. You look in inside, you see the reflection of over 18 million candles to commemorate the 1.5 million children who perished. Shpilo in Yiddish means Germans, a mirror. Mirror the image. You hear a tape in Yiddish, Hebrew, and English, and the children perished, so you want to run out. And inside you've got a barrel of wine, the one thing you don't hear is your own. If you're an Ashkenazic ancestry, the only reason you're here is because of your miracle. Your grandparents, your great grandparents. And no one thought, whoever was saved, no one thought they were highest of those that perished. And I think about this probably every day. Moshe had many beautiful names. Avigdor, Tuvia, Yedidia, and yet in the end, he's always known as Moshe. He made a mind in Shisiru. He's drawn forth from the water. He always had that visage before his eyes. They could have been crocodile fodder at the bottom of the river. But he was saying something significant on his behalf of his people. To all of you, you're doing something significant. And there's a lot to know. Don't be. You're doing something significant on your behalf of our people, Ashrei.